Felix, First Citizen. When the First Citizen has a bad night's sleep, he likes to share. You have been recalled to the capital on urgent business. Certain currency triangulation transactions require your personal biometric signature as one of the trustees of the National Bank. And so it is, no major surprise when your morning starts with the plaintive twiddle of the sat phone. It sits on one of the fake Louis XIV bedside tables in your hotel suite. You roll over, dislodging the blonde Ukrainian girl from her death grip on the bolster. Why is she still here? Doesn't she have a bed of her own to go to? And pick up the handset.
Colonel Datka, sir, this is Eagle's Nest.
Yes, yes, you say irritably, trying to focus on the illuminated dial of the alarm clock. It's 4:30, but when the Eagle's Nest calls, it is rash to hang up. What is it?
His Excellency is asking for you. Are you presentable? We have a car en route.
Shit, you think. Is Baska all right? You recognize the voice at the other end of the line. It's one of the First Citizen's regular bodyguards, Dmitri something, an ethnic Russian. Minor reassurance. A stranger's voice would be worrying. I will be ready in 5 minutes, you say, and stifle a fear-threaded yawn. Is there anything I should be prepared for?
I don't think so.
Dmitri sounds uncertain.
He had a very disturbed night. The usual is all.
I'll be ready. You reassure the man and hang up. The brunette has noticed your usual morning stiffening and is rubbing her lips against your manhood, but you have other needs. You shove her face away and clamber across her, pad past the empty champagne bucket towards the ensuite bathroom. The solid silver urinal in the shape of a gaping, open-mouthed cherub swallows your steaming piss stream. Make yourselves useful and find me some clean underwear, you grunt at the girls. I have an appointment with the First Citizen.
Yes, Colonel, they echo with the precisely correct degree of respect tinged with awe.
They're almost annoyingly well-trained. Say anything you like about the plumbing. The Erkindik Hotel front desk supplies the best whores in Bishkek, if not the whole of Kyrgyzstan. 10 minutes later, you're presentable in the uniform of a colonel in the Army Intelligence Directorate, gold braid and red shoulder tabs and 3 rows of brightly polished medals, no less than is your due, as you head downstairs to the hotel lobby. Baska offered to promote you to Lieutenant General a couple of times, but only halfway down the vodka bottle. Tact, or prudence, has kept you from reminding him of this when he's sober. In any case, Chief of Military Overseas Intelligence is a colonel's position in these half-assed times. You don't want to give General Medvedev cause to think you're making a play for his job. 2 black-suited fellows from the Presidential Security Detachment are waiting for you in the lobby. 4 more stand on the sidewalk by the beetle-shiny armored Mercedes. They see you safely on board, and seconds later you're slamming through the deserted pre-dawn boulevards of the capital in the middle of a convoy of armed pickup trucks, blue lights flickering off the concrete frontages to either side, your armed guards scanning for threats with gun-sight eyes. The American has weaseled his way into your entourage again. Let them have his illusory privilege of access. It's so much easier to keep an eye on him when he thinks he's keeping an eye on you. He's sitting in the middle jump seat opposite, clutching his pad in both hands like a determined chipmunk who refuses to give up his nut. "What is it this time?" you ask, staring pointedly at him.
"It's the exchange rate."
Blue fireflies flicker and gleam inside his rimless glasses. All it takes is a 2-point fluctuation and we lose $100 million on the exchanges. He doesn't smile. How long is it since you could always tell an American by their smile? Good dentistry is expensive. Flashing bright teeth in these straitened times is like wearing a jacket that says, "Mug me." Can you talk him out of it? You suppress a sigh. You seem to think Baska is a tame bullock, to be herded this way and that. He isn't, and if you persist in this mode of thinking, he will give you a nasty surprise. The American's lips curl. "Who's running this, you or the operation?" he asks. "Without our collateral, you'd be..." You smile without showing your teeth. He stops chittering, gratifyingly fast. Chipmunk American has seen a pit viper. "We are duly grateful to our investors. Nevertheless, you will refrain from discussing the First Citizen in language more appropriate for cattle. Without his continuing patronage, your operation is nothing. We are not stupid, Mr. White. If you didn't need our special expertise, you wouldn't be engaged in this joint venture with those crazy Kyrgyz." It's hard to tell if Mr. White blanches in the strobing glow of the street lamps and the blue LEDs of the lead escort, but your choice of words echoes his own language. "Stupid little geek probably imagines you cracked the encryption on his secure VoIP link, forgetting who owns all the bandwidth in and out of both countries, both Kyrgyzstan and the recession-hit sock puppet in the east that he's using for his little logistics operation." "I'm sorry," he says. "Leave Baska to me," you reassure him, "and leave the currency stabilization talks alone. Your concerns are noted, and I agree. It would be absolutely deplorable to lose 100 million euros of your money through inattention. Nevertheless, attempting to micromanage the First Citizen would be unwise. Trust me on this. I've known him for more than 40 years. Since you were both in the Young Pioneers together, back in the dog days of the Soviet Union. You consider saying more to the creep, promising a little something to sweeten the deal and keep suckering him in. But at that point the convoy slows, and the car turns sharply, nosing over a recessed barrier and down a steep ramp into an underground security checkpoint and parking garage. It's under the back of the new wing, across the street from the White House. Baska's office and bachelor pad, a hideous lump of white marble that looks like a tax office fucking an airport terminal. You leave the operations representative sitting in the limo as the guards salute and wave you forward across the crimson carpet and into the elevator, with the best Korean terahertz radar and explosive sniffers hidden in its walnut-veneered walls. Then it's into the corridor under the road, and another elevator that whisks you upstairs. Then down another corridor that serves as a security firebreak for the guards on Baska's private quarters to check you out, and finally another elevator. Then the doors slide open, and you're in Xanadu. Xanadu is 3 stories high, 10 meters on the side, and occupies about an eighth of the presidential palace's floor plan. It's mounted on shock absorbers, driven into bedrock, and hermetically sealed from the rest of the White House by steel plates embedded in the walls. An insulated bubble of purest lunacy, the personal quarters of the First Citizen of the Republic of Kyrgyzstan. Whoever designed it was clearly channeling Samuel Coleridge on dodgy pharmaceuticals by way of Norman Foster, rather than the ghost of Kubla Khan. But beggars and first citizens can't be choosers. It came to light after you'd finished kicking that bum Adskan into exile in Prague. Personally, if it had been you, you'd have demolished the thing rather than sleep in it. But after the second assassination attempt, Bhaskar got the message and retreated inside his predecessor's hermetically sealed pleasure dome. You find him sitting in the sunken circular seat with the fish tank floor and pink leather cushions, wearing one of those Japanese dressing gown things, and looking morose. There are bags under his eyes, and he has neglected to shave. His big, bony feet splay across the glass, footprints for the rainbow carp to gape and mouth at from beneath. "Is it morning?" he asks, hopefully. "It will be soon." You carefully descend the steps. You never trusted that glass floor not to dump you in the water, and embrace cheek to cheek. "Are you well, brother? What's troubling you?" "I can't sleep." The first citizen, you remember playing tag in the woods out behind the apartment block you both lived in, looks despondent. "The pills aren't helping. I feel like I'm going mad at times, let me tell you. It's this artificial light. I never see the sun these days. Bad dreams whenever I manage to get to sleep." He rubs his index finger alongside his crooked, slightly splayed nose. "We should get you a woman." You stop when you see the look in his eyes. He hasn't been the same since Yelena died. Some men need all the women they can get, but for others, one is all they want for a lifetime. "Or a bottle of vodka and some dirty videos. When did we last kick back with a good movie?" Now his shoulders relax. "I'm supposed to tutor a meeting of the All-Republic Commission on Finance this afternoon," he says quietly. "Most of those fucking peasants wouldn't know a credit default swap if it bit them on the bell end. And listen, they aren't paying me to teach macroeconomics at the State Academy anymore. Those bastards, if they were my students, they'd be heading for a fail. All they can think of is lining their own pockets. What the fuck do they care about the future?" "The committee will still be there tomorrow and the day after," you point out. "Send a reliable deputy." Now you understand the expression. "What is it?" "What indeed?" He raises an eyebrow. "It's the future. I've been thinking about it a lot lately." "What?" "Listen." The first citizen glances away. "Suppose I ordered you to arrest the American, the investment agent. No reason given. Just shut his little crime syndicate down right now and bugger the big picture. Would you do it?" "For you, boss? Of course. In a split instant." You shrug. "Of course, it would make a real mess," you add conspiratorially. Subtext, you'd completely fuck over our past 2 years' work. "Right, right." Bhaskar limply punches the open palm of his left hand, winces slightly from the carpal tunnel syndrome that's plagued him for decades. "You'd do it. But first you make sure I am fully informed as to the consequences." Little does he truly appreciate the real risks involved. It's your job to protect your unworldly genius of a childhood friend from the real-world consequences of such a whim. To ensure that when it's time for you to bring the hammer down and Basker to fix the deficit, there are no overlooked survivors with enough money to pay for assassins. I'm not asking you to do that, but the point is, at least I know where you stand. You're not afraid to tell me, but those fuckers on the All-State Council, that ratbag Kumanbek smiles like a vulture and makes nicey-nicey noises, but do you think he'd lend me a horse if my pony was lamed?
Kumanbek is the vice president, or rather the ethnic Uzbek counterweight in the ruling coalition Basker presides over. In other words, nuisance central. And of course Basker's right. If he asked Kumanbek the time, the answer would be whatever was most convenient for the Veep. Is the committee's immediate agenda critical, you ask? Because if not, why not send Kumanbek to deputize? I'll have someone listen in. You're talking about bugging a state committee, and compare the minutes to what actually gets said. Worst case, you skip class. Best case, Kumanbek hands you some live ammunition. But either way, you need a couple of days off, boss. Kick back with a couple of bottles and some decadent Iranian musicals. Maybe a game. When did you last go on an epic quest? The first citizen brightens. You're right, Felix. I should skip school more often. You nod. Encouraging. It's got to be a horrible life trapped here in a hermetically sealed bubble inside a presidential palace, unable to go out in daylight without a platoon of soldiers with fixed bayonets on all sides, children grown up, and wife dead of a stroke these past 3 years. Not to mention that fucking annoying Georgian extradition warrant floating around Interpol like an unexploded bomb. You know Basker didn't order the guards to fire on that crowd. It was a horrible fuck-up by an idiot second lieutenant. But the upshot is he's stuck here in the middle of Bishkek, not even able to go to the casinos in St. Petersburg for an evening at the roulette table. Or whatever it is that he enjoys. Knowing Basker, given the choice, he'd probably disguise himself as a professor, sneak into the university campus, and teach a seminar on the history of monetarism. If all the Republic's previous president's vices were as recondite as his, Moscow would be coming to you for loans. You've had a ringside seat, seen what it's doing to your childhood friend, watched him reduced to fishing for assurances that he's still loved, shuffling around his carpeted pleasure prison in the dark. If any smiling bastard tried to convince you to front a coup, you'd shoot him yourself, you think, just to stay out of the presidential padded cell. Then the first citizen puts a friendly arm around your shoulder and drops you in it, head first. But tell me now, how is the Przewalsk business coming along? I've been fielding questions from the EU ambassador's office, but they're becoming more insistent, and that whining louse Borisovich in state is starting to give me back chat.
The Operation. Blofeld Blues. There is no saber-scarred, monocle-wearing, bullet-headed bad guy stroking a white cat at the center of this conspiracy. Nor are there any tropical island bases patrolled by Komodo dragons, assault rifle-toting boiler-suited henchmen, or stolen nuclear weapons. The wildest conspiracies are the quietest. This one started out as a venture capital partnership that has opted for mutual unlimited liability, in lieu of filing certain important papers that the Internal Revenue Service would be very interested in seeing. In this decade, the United States faces a cumulative gross budget deficit of around $30 trillion, or about 16 trillion euros, or 20 trillion renminbi. It's the hangover from a century of imperial overstretch, the flip side of the butcher's bill from trying to force the world to play by the conqueror's rulebook for too long. The IRS is grabbing every bent cent they can find these days, trying to outrun the law of compound interest. However, their intrusive banking compliance regime doesn't reach as far as it did a decade or more ago, because foreigners aren't terribly scared of Uncle Sam anymore. For the rising powers of the BRIC, helping the US government balance its books is not exactly high on the agenda of realpolitik. So while most Americans get to tighten their belts and swallow a painful prescription from the IMF, the few, the lucky, those who invested their assets overseas before the money supply exploded in the wake of one banking crisis too many, are stranded facing a 90% marginal tax rate if they try to repatriate their wealth. Hence the operation. Invest overseas, invest efficiently, invest for maximum growth, and who gives a fuck about collateral damage? They're foreigners. They got us into this mess, and now they're holding our heads underwater by debasing our currency. Fuck 'em if they can't take a joke. The operation is nominally headquartered in California. To the IRS, and anyone else who inquires, it appears to be a small, somewhat lackadaisical investment partnership with a software subsidiary who maintain the expert systems its strategic planning runs on. A couple of successful companies huddle close to the parent organization's feet. A small ISP, a private management college, not that anyone's paying for MBAs this decade, when they could be training as plumbers or auto mechanics instead, and an offshore secretarial bureau. As VC firms go, the only thing distinguishing the operation from its peers is how undistinguished it looks. Its managers seem to have poor judgment, funding too many second-rate entrepreneurs who drop out of sight after a couple of months. It's almost as if they don't want to make a profit, don't feel the visionary's urge to set the world ablaze. Komodo dragons, nuclear missiles, and island bases are all high-maintenance overheads. They're inefficient, and the operation values efficiency above all else. The operation proactively recruits executive-caliber material from among the unfairly discriminated against neurodiverse. It provides a supportive and caring environment in which these battered souls can grow and be all that they want to be. The hate word, psychopath, conjures up visions of knife-wielding maniacs, but that's a far cry from the reality of the operation's entrepreneurial spirit. In reality, it's an unacknowledged truth that amidst the cut and thrust of boardroom politics, a touch of antisocial personality disorder is an asset. The operation merely makes the best of its human resources, polishes and trains them to keep their natural impulsive drives harnessed to the wagon of success. Their classes in corporate and managerial ethics really are first-rate. By the time they graduate and leave the nest, the new entrepreneurs know exactly what they must do to succeed. One of the dirty little truths of organized crime is that, for the most part, its management is incompetent. No business exists in a vacuum, and no enterprise, criminal or otherwise, can succeed unless its clients and suppliers trust each other. Unreliable, incompetent, greedy, grasping, poor impulse control, these traits drag down and dismember the management of Ndrangheta, cripple the profitability of the Yakuza, and hamstring the Russian mafia. They're slow learners. Even as late as the early noughties, organized crime had barely begun to absorb the lessons of modern management. As for innovation, Al Capone would have recognized most of their business models on sight. The operation knows one thing and knows it well: how to set up and manage a business for maximum growth until it's time to negotiate a successful sale and cash out. They have single-handedly dragged the management of vice into the late 20th century, if not the 21st. A monumental, if questionable, achievement. But now, they're under attack. The operations business is at its most effective when it can tap new audiences, gain new customers, expand markets, reach out to new sources of profit. Lack of brand awareness is the biggest obstacle to establishing any new sales channel, legal or otherwise, and you can't advertise counterfeit goods or illegal services through regulated media. Consequently, the operation is highly dependent on all kinds of spam, from shoutcasting on in-game voice channels to the old search engine optimization racket. Over the past 3 days, more than 50 individuals have died in unlikely and frequently messy manners: electrocuted by miswired domestic robots, heart stopped by improbable prescribing errors, driven off the edge of multi-story car parks by malfunctioning car autopilots, shot by police in raids on the wrong address. Most of these people are not actual affiliates or employees of the operation. They are, however, all involved at one level or another in the unregulated network marketing sector. Something must be done. Part 2. Liz. Moat, I, Redux. There's one good thing about being seconded to run interference for Dodgy Dickie's murder investigation, and it's this. CID always gets allocated the best cars, right after traffic. They get the same priority as the regular community patrols, and that's a hell of a long way up the pecking order from ICIU. When you show up at the transport desk this time, you don't have to grovel for a segue. Instead, there's an unmarked Chinese Volvo waiting for you, silver-grey luxury on wheels. As you slide behind the wheel and orient yourself with the controls, you see it's got a console full of extras on the passenger side: traffic data terminal, ANPR cameras, external laser projector, the works. So this is how the other half drive, you think enviously as you thumb the airport short-stay car park into the autopilot and hit the go button. A moment later, the car reverses out into the station yard and turns towards Queens Ferry Road in eerie silence. You're halfway to Turnhouse before it fires up the diesel generator under the bonnet. Self-driving cars are a mixed blessing. Right now, you miss the bad old days when you needed to keep your hands on the wheel and your eyes on the road. It'd be a welcome distraction. But current health and safety regulations say that only officers assigned to ongoing pursuit and patrol driving duties, and the training that goes with them, are allowed to actually operate vehicles. It's something to do with the force being liable for damages if you run over any civilians. So you use the spare quarter hour to dig into the cop space image of Dickie's incident room and try to familiarize yourself with who's doing what and how far they've got so far. The car parks itself in a police-only bay near domestic EU arrivals at Terminal 1. You head for the meeting point adjacent to customs with a sinking heart. Cop space at the airport is congested, full of security warnings and immigration tags, as well as the usual detritus: criminals on probation, minicab drivers with unpaid licenses, and the like. But after a minute, your specs lock on to someone and flicker for attention. You see a vaguely familiar face in the crowd, towing a neat carry-on bag as he stands in front of the exit, scanning. Yes, that's him. You start forward. Medium height, dark eyes, Middle Eastern skin, sharp suit. He's looking around, but he hasn't clocked you yet. He's alone this time, no mob of supercop extras in tow. His head turns. Kemal Aslan, I presume, you say, preempting him. Welcome back to Scotland. His expression of annoyance is so quickly masked you can't be sure it even exists. Is it your imagination? And he extends a hand.
Ah, Inspector Kavanagh.
You take it and shake. His palm is cool and dry.
I hope you're well.
He ducks his head. It's a long way from the arrogant confidence he exuded the first time you saw him 5 years ago. Well enough. You gesture towards the exit. I've got a car. How long are you here for?
As long as it takes.
You head for the doors. He follows.
If you wouldn't mind stopping en route, I need to check in at my hotel. Then we should talk.
You stop. I'm not entirely clear on what you think there is to talk about. You snap, and he recoils as if you've just bared your teeth at him. We've got a sensitive, time-critical investigation to run, and unless you've got some insight to contribute, something that we should know, you're just not that high a priority. To your surprise, he nods.
I appreciate that, he says softly, but it is not the only investigation in progress. I'm here to help. All of them. On my previous visit, we started out badly. I will apologize if that is what you desire, but afterwards we must work together. It's very important.
You manage not to gape at him, but you're momentarily at a loss. He delivers his spiel with a deadpan sincerity that leaves you scrabbling for a handle to hang your anger on. Finally, you manage to say, "In the car. We can discuss this later." Then you start walking again, so wound up that you're as jerky as a marionette. The car is halfway to his hotel, a boutique establishment in Haymarket, before he speaks again.
Has there been any progress in your investigation?
I need to get you signed on and authorized before I can disclose intelligence material. You're already working out a shortest path in your head, a circuit of the necessary offices. You need to drag Kemal past the super's office door for pro forma approval, then your own desk to verify that authentication of his credentials is already in the channel via Europol, then up to Doc, who can tell one of his sergeants to give him external consulting access to the virtual incident room. His eagerness to get started ahead of the formalities is grating and borderline toxic. But then you ask yourself, what would you do in his shoes? Can you tell me what's going on from your end of things?
It's a massacre, he says simply.
For a moment you think you misheard. A what?
A massacre?
He stares out through the ghost of the head-up display as the tidy shop fronts of Kostorfin slide past.
We have linked 8 deaths to the atrocity already. They all occurred within a 6-hour period, but the incident is ongoing. I expect more to come to light.
It's a really good thing the car's driving itself. Otherwise the force would probably be looking at an out-of-court settlement, and you'd be looking at the inside of an ambulance. What? Where's this coming from?
The victims all died within the same period. They died at home, in circumstances superficially resembling domestic accidents. They were all involved in online marketing activities of questionable legality. Some of them were found immediately. Others took time to be discovered. We are currently examining a number of other deaths over the same period. I expect the number to rise, sharply.
8 murders? You find the figure implausible, comically ludicrous. That's more murders than Edinburgh gets in a year, a really bad year at that. It puts you in mind of stories you heard at Uncle Bert's knee from his time in the RUC during the Troubles. A faint inkling begins to dawn on you. Tell me this isn't political. More of that shit like 5 years ago. Kamal is shaking his head emphatically. It's not political. That's hard to argue with. What kind of regular terrorist would target spammers? The car cruises past a gaggle of uniformed schoolchildren on the pavement. That's an extra $500,000 in damages in the parallel universe where you're supposed to have your hands on the wheel. So who do you think it is? You ask him.
Not who, but what.
He clams up, jaw shut. Uh-huh. Does not compute. In my experience, crimes usually have perpetrators.
But this is not a normal crime, asserts Kamal. It is a cluster of anomalous deaths, distributed geographically but sharing a common je ne sais quoi and occurring nearly simultaneously. This is not the symptom of normal criminal activity, no?
Oh, bullshit! Next thing you'll be telling me, it's aliens or artificial intelligence or some other science fictional nonsense. He's looking at you intently.
It all depends on what you mean by artificial intelligence.
You blink rapidly. How many kinds could there be? The ocular tick sets cop space in a tizzy, flashing through stacks of overlays that flicker across the staid, stone-fronted houses. Prevalence of porn downloads, undischarged ASBOs, unclosed burglary tickets. Has someone been building HAL 9000 in their basement, then? The car slows, then turns into a side street.
Not to the best of my knowledge.
Kamal looks unhappy.
But I have been spending too much time tracking fraudsters on the internet, he adds elliptically. The spammers, they're ingenious. The programmers have a saying, you know. If we understand how we do it, it isn't artificial intelligence anymore. Playing chess, driving cars, generating conversational text that can convince humans it's an old friend and please to click on this download link.
He clears his throat.
You use internet search engines, don't you?
What? Like Google?
The programmers have another saying. The question of whether a machine can think is no more interesting than the question of whether a submarine can swim. The search engines, they are not artificial intelligences, synthetic consciousnesses. They don't need to be. Perhaps we overestimate consciousness. After all, the spam filters everyone uses, you may not think you're using one, but your service providers handle the job on your behalf, are very good at telling human beings from bots, and the bots are good too. They get better and better at emulating human communication, insinuating themselves into our conversations all the time. For the past 3 years, they have been able to pass a non-iterative Turing test administered by human beings more often than real human controls. We can't distinguish spam from ham, not as reliably as our filters. And the filters are still fallible even though they're learning all the time.
You've had enough of this bullshit. With respect, Inspector Aslan, I don't see what this has to do with our culpable homicide investigation. Software didn't reach out of the net and spike Mr. Blair's enema fluid. There's a human agency involved at some level, and that's what we're going to find. Now, I will grant you... You catch yourself on the edge of finger-wagging and issue yourself a cease and desist, just like the persuasion counsellor warned you to. Someone may be using spam filters to track and to trace criminals involved in the bulk advertising industry, but you're not going to convince me that there's some murderous piece of software that's out to kill. You're almost spluttering, and that's even more of a C&D situation when it comes to influencing people. So you make yourself stop. Kamal is looking at you with a heavy-lidded expression that gives you a weird shiver of déjà vu.
You are correct. Spam filters do not kill, he says calmly. But people using spam filters to backtrace and select their targets are another matter.
But why? You shake your head. It doesn't make sense.
I agree with you,
he says with exaggerated acidic dignity.
But somebody is killing them. Our task is to discover who, is it not?
The car slows, then noses into a hotel car park while you're trying to come up with a sufficiently scathing rejoinder. Then you suddenly remember where you've seen his expression before. In the bathroom mirror this very morning, while you were choking on the sure knowledge that you knew something important about the Blair investigation, but that dodgy Dicky was certain not to give you the time of day. Moot. I. Redux. Kamal doesn't say another word as the car parks itself, but his expression says it all for him.
I need 10 minutes to drop my bag, he says, opening the car door.
Of course. You climb out of the Volvo and collect his wheelie bag from the boot. The car beeps and shuts down behind you as you take the escalator up to the lobby. You install yourself in an understuffed leather sofa at one side as Kamal does his business with a self-service check-in, picks up a keycard, and is whisked upstairs to salaryman limbo. Kamal gives you just enough time to do the necessary 180 reorientation and get your shit squared away. You're just finishing up a memo to Doc, necessary clearances for Kamal when he reappears. That was fast.
I said I only needed time to drop my bag.
You could swear he looks wounded, but those big brown eyes of his make it his default state.
Are we going now?
In a moment. You fold your desktop away into a corner of your left eye and lever yourself ungracefully out of the sofa. Then you dust yourself down. There's a passable coffee shop round the corner, you tell him. I think you and I ought to go there and discuss the spam thing over a latte. Before I take you round the shop and get you into the system. He gives you the hairy eyeball.
What is there to discuss?
It's not inflected as a question. We started out on the wrong foot. You take a deep breath. I apologize for what it's worth. I'll give you a fair hearing, but you need to know what you're walking into before you stick your nose round the incident room door. Kamal exhales.
Politics?
You could say that.
I think a small espresso would be a good idea, he concedes.
In that case, you're not entirely sure why the sudden turnaround with respect to Kamal, but there are several factors feeding into it. It's hard to stay furious at an abstract, and meeting him face to face, you recognize only too clearly the stink of failure to launch. You may have been treading water for 5 years, but Kamal spent them sliding down the greasy pole. Stripped of the Eurocop arrogance and the entourage of men in black, he's just a sad-faced little cop with a briefcase full of nightmares. And then there's the matter in hand. 8 deaths. You don't owe Kamal the time of day, but it'd be grossly, unforgivably unprofessional to let your personal dislike get in the way of his investigation. Sitting in the fake 80s bachelor pad bistro hell coffee shop, you lay it all out for him. You're walking in on a high-profile murder investigation. Lead investigator is Detective Chief Inspector Dickie McLeish. He and I have a history, and it's not a good one. To be fair, he has a headache because, firstly, Edinburgh usually gets maybe one murder a month, and secondly, the victim in this investigation had money and connections. He's under the spotlight already, and adding a foreign connection is... Copspace clears its throat discreetly. You hold up a cautioning hand to Kamal and glance at the incoming. It takes a second or two to make sense of it, then you swear under your breath. It's a flash broadcast from the virtual situation room, which is exceptional in its own right. They'd usually only do that to alert everyone to an arrest warrant for a dangerous fugitive. This one is even more unusual. 9, you tell Kamal. His face, glimpsed through a slew of rapidly accreting wiki notes, doesn't look remotely surprised.
Who?
He asks. One Vivian Crawler, accountant by trade. You read swiftly, then take in the preliminary crime scene scans. Jesus! You can't help yourself. Somebody shrink-wrapped her to a mattress full of banknotes.
They what?
Now he raises an eyebrow. You blink the overlay aside. We should go and get you signed in, you suggest. How should I know who they are? You wonder defensively. What kind of lunatic goes around shrink-wrapping people to bales of banknotes? Michael Blair was one of her customers.
Ah.
Kamal raises his tiny cup, pulls a face, and knocks back his ristretto in one. You eye your own cup. It's half full. Regretfully, you stand and turn your back on it.
Lead on,
he says. Back at HQ, it's as if a giant virtual boot has kicked over the anthill. You normally get plenty of passing trade at the station, but it's mostly beat cops checking in petty shoplifters and such like at this time of day. Two bizarro world murders in rapid succession, with rumours of a Eurotrash gangland connection, have got folks nervous. They remember the hideous mess 5 years ago when everything fell over. Back to manual typewriters and anonymous prepay mobiles, while the spooks ran around upgrading the security keys on all the nation's key routers and praying that the hackers responsible weren't fucking with the air traffic control system or the reactor complex at Torness. The atmosphere today is a lot like that. Word has got around the canteen grapevine that something really out of order is going on. And you're getting the hairy eyeball from all sides as soon as you walk up to the desk in reception and sign a visitor's badge for Kamal. You run him straight upstairs to C.I. Dixon's office, where Doc's secretary casually signs his ID onto the system. Logging his biometrics solely on your say-so, talk about being granted a sufficiency of rope for career asphyxiation. Then you herd him along the corridor to IT support, where a pathologically detached civilian contractor registers his phone and gets him logged into Copspace. You've just short-circuited about 2 days of procedures specifically designed to prevent J. Random Unauthorized Person from getting into IT support's hair, but you're in no mood to take shit right now. If Kamal's right about the scale of what's going on, Dickie needs to know the shape of the tiger he's got by the tail. And so, less than 2 hours after you picked him up, you're back in front of the door to briefing room D-31. Inspector Kavanagh. Dickie looks up from the surface in the middle of the room. It's displaying a 3D cutaway of a typical Edinburgh tenement, one-sixth of life size, with Soko annotations hazing the air above it as thickly as the cigarette smoke of an earlier generation. This would be... Inspector Kamal Aslan, on assignment to Europol Business Affairs in Brussels from Emniyet Genel Müdürlüğü in Ankara. Kamal clears his throat.
We have been monitoring an upswing in violent deaths of individuals engaged in the internet fraud sector.
He meets Dickie McLeish's fiercely sceptical gaze. 8 so far, across Europe, all within 48 hours. 9 now. You tag-team with him, piling it up on MacLeish. Inspector Aslan is ready to give you an overview of the larger picture whenever you're ready. I checked him in with IT. He's on the system. His auths from Europol check out. Which is an important point, as it's not so long ago that a nutter with a cop fetish managed to fast-talk his way onto a prostitution sweep in Portobello. Kamal doesn't switch target. We believe there is a common mechanism behind the killings, although proving a culpable human perpetrator may be... He's about to get stuck into his spiel when a uniform from CID shoulders his way into your circle and clears his throat apologetically. "Inspectors?" He nods at Dickie. "Skipper, got a moment?" "Aye." Dickie cuts you dead of an instant. Kamal's neck muscles tense at that, but he bites his tongue like he's had lots of practice lately. You peer closer at the crime scene on the virtual dissecting table. It's one of those upper stairwell flats with a windowless hall and rooms branching off it on all sides. There's something in the living room like a discarded square-cut sandwich. "The Blair scene yesterday, his ID was in the name of John, Christie. It's just that it rang a bell with Mary as she was compiling the daily for oversight. She's got a true crime reading habit, and she looked him up online, and he's a ringer, sir." "What kind of ringer?" Dickie's diction is clipped. He looks like he's going to blow a gasket. Not unusual for him, but even so. "John Reginald Halliday Christie, just like we logged on this guy's driving license, was a serial killer, sir. The Notting Hill Strangler, hanged for murder in 1953. He pronounces that last with relish. There are quite a few in this building who'd like to see those days of rope-burn closure back again. After he'd set up his neighbour, Timothy Evans, to take the drop for him." Dickie's left eyelid is twitching. Your cheek is threatening to come out in sympathy. "You're telling me that the civilian capture and release contact on the Blair house was using false ID in the name of a serial killer, and nobody clocked it?" Constable Ballantyne shakes his head. "Constable Brown logged his ID and took a swab, sir. The driving license checked out with DVLA, and the mugshot matched. It wasn't false at that level." Now your cheek does twitch, because this is the kind of shit that isn't supposed to happen. The driver and vehicle licensing agency database backs onto the identity and passport services database, and you can't get a driving license without authenticating. Which means the joker who just horned in on your crime scene is walking around with a genuine identity record on the national system in the name of a long-ago executed serial killer. The birth date on his driving license... Constable Brown didn't clock it at the time. He was just checking that the name and face were valid. But in the database, it's given as 15th of July 1953, the day the real Christie was executed. I reviewed Ed's helmet video, and the fly bastard sure doesn't look 70. He's been rattling on into a growing circle of silence for almost 30 seconds, oblivious to the gigantic loaf he's pinched in the middle of the investigation. It's becoming glaringly obvious that someone is deliberately fucking with the brains of Edinburgh's finest and wants you to know it. Dickie, no cool cucumber at the best of times, is giving you serious concern for his ticker. Half the uniforms in the room are desperately trying not to boggle and failing. The other half aren't even trying. A vein pulses weirdly in MacLeish's forehead, then a curious ripple in the hairy salt-and-pepper caterpillar that passes for his moustache presages 6 urgently grunted words, pulled from so deep in his abdomen that you'd think DC Ballantyne had just kneed him in the nuts. Whoever this fucker is, pull him. Then, as an aside, Dickie adds, find that swab and run it on the... No. He nods formally at Kamal. Put it on the wire to Europol and flag it as a suspect implicated in Inspector Aslan's investigation. And run it on NDNAD. Then backtrace the driving license, find out who issued it, and open a new investigation. How this ringer got onto the IPS database. There'll be a counterfeiting offence in there, probably more than one. He knuckles his forehead as if squeezing out more charges, then glances at you and Kamal. If you'll excuse me, I've got to update the super now. His banked anger is still there, but it's not pointed your way any more. What a pile of... He claws at an invisible target. Shit! The silence dissolves in a buzz of crosstalk. Kicked anthills, indeed. This might be a breakthrough in the long run, but in the short term, it's every case manager's nightmare. To have a suspect walk right into the middle of the crime scene, bare their arse at the officers on the spot, and waltz out again. The prurient eyes of Edinburgh are upon you, and this is juicy enough that it's not going to stay under wraps for long. It's going to be top of every news crawl within hours, and Dickie's the one who'll bear the brunt of the jokes and finger-pointing. Deprived of responsibility for the moment, you take the opportunity to walk around the table, showing Kamal how the investigation is set up. Every police force does things differently. He nods appreciatively and asks sensible questions as you discreetly bring yourself up to speed. The Crawler scene is just as bizarre as the Blair bathroom. Here, a mattress stuffed with long-withdrawn £1 notes that were cancelled more than a decade ago, even before the Euro switchover. There, a woman's body, still wearing a business suit, shrink-wrapped onto the mattress with industrial-strength plastic sheeting. Preliminary pathology report. Cause of death. Anaphylactic shock. Victim unconscious prior to death. The occlusive layer alone wasn't fatal, and there's no bruising or signs suggestive of forcible immobilization.
There's something wrong about this, Kamal tells you, just as one of the uniforms walks over. It's more recent, and besides, there is violent human agency.
Inspector? You squint at the constable. It's Mary Maguire, with the real-life crime hobby. She's looking worried about something. Yes? I've got a call from the West End control desk. Someone wants an inspector on scene, and for some reason they put it through here, and, Inspector Max up to his eyeballs. Can you take it? Several thoughts come to mind, the first of which is, you have to be kidding, but it would never do to say that. It would put you firmly in not-a-team-player territory, which is not what you want to do if you aspire to ever go back to CID work. And precisely, who do you think you are kidding about that? So you bite everything back and nod. Transfer it. A moment later you hear a still, small voice with a pronounced Ayrshire accent in your right ear.
Inspector, control room here. We have a call from Sergeant McBride for a DI to provide oversight on a scene in Polwarth, and the house is flagged in cop space with a prior you were involved with. Boots pulled your name out of the hat with a flag for another suspicious death that might bear on Operation Babylon.
Your eyeballs track to the translucent sign hovering above the investigation wiki.
Oh, Jesus, not again!
I'll be right over. Send me the case workflow, you say. Then you catch Kamal's eye. Come along. Apparently, we've got another one.